We are in chapter 3. Moses hanging out in the desert, and he's right. He's no prince. Not any longer. He was now a sheep herder. And you know, let's not skip too far past this part of his life and what has happened with him, because it would be kind of like, you know, I mean, think across the pond, right? Think Prince Harry. Think, you know, no end to the money at his disposal, high profile, well-educated, being escorted around in a limo. And then the very next day, what does he find himself? He finds himself in a dead-end job in a poor slum of London, wondering where his next meal is going to come from. Wow. Moses, what a transformation from just a week ago. He's been in Midian, though, now for about 40 years, which means he's pushing 80. And we continue the story in chapter 3, verse 1. Now, Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of a bush, and he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. So Moses had arrived at Horeb. It was quite a distance from his new home, probably arriving there out of necessity as a sheep herder in the desert. Your options get to be fairly limited as to where the grazing potential is. And he literally found himself moving physically closer toward Egypt, as a matter of fact, as he crossed the desert, coming upon this area around what we understand as around Mount Sinai. And he finds this fertile spot, and he sets camp in that location. And, you know, when you really start thinking about this in the context of Moses' entire life, look at how God was preparing him. He had been hanging around in the desert now for about 40 years. He had gotten pretty well used to the desert. He understood it. Now, I don't think he had any idea that he was going to be the deliverer yet, and that not only in that role of deliverer, he would be wandering around in the desert again. But that was to come. Well, he sees fire. And that's not uncommon either, right? I mean, even in the desert, a renegade thunderstorm, a lightning strike, all of a sudden this bush or a tree catches on fire. But not this time. This fire was different. In verse 2, we find one of the significant differences is that actually the angel of the Lord is in the bush. Now, theologians have a word for God speaking, manifesting himself physically. It's called a theophany, and this would be one of those moments in Scripture. Now, what we also find in a lot of conservative theologians' writing is that they actually classify this as not just a theophany, but a Christophany. And what that means is that actually in this moment, the pre-incarnate Christ, anytime you see the angel of the Lord, rather than an angel of the Lord, but the angel of the Lord, in that moment, the pre-incarnate Christ is appearing here in the Old Testament, as also in Genesis 18 with Abraham and Sarah, and Genesis 32 with Joseph and others. So whatever is at play here, what we know for sure is that God is in this moment, and we know he's in this moment, and symbolically he shows himself in this moment with fire. And again, that makes perfectly good sense when you look at all of Scripture. We find God making his covenant with Abraham, and there's fire associated with that. We find Acts chapter 2 as the early church begins to form, and what happens as the Holy Spirit comes, there's fire. And he wants Moses to know he is here. And God has certainly gotten Moses' attention. And now that he does, Moses discovers quite a bit about this God of his forefathers. You wonder exactly what Moses remembered after 40 years. What were those stories that he had learned when he was just a child? when he was a tiny child. Tonight we're going to look at how Moses' encounter with God gives him some significance, some significant biblical truths about God. Eight, in fact. And that's a lot, and I get that. Now, the beauty of actually getting a lot of information out in a short period of time here is that if you haven't done this yet, you can actually go to the YouVersion app on your phone. If you haven't received that yet, you can download that app. And when you get to the app, you can actually scroll to the live portion. If you haven't done that yet, you can go to live and then find the actual service that we are participating in right here online. And then what's really cool about it is once you pull it up, it's not only it only has the notes for tonight. See, some of you are already doing that. That's really cool. That's fine. This is interactive. We can play along. It's all good. And the scriptures for tonight are there. And then there are places for you to take notes. And here's where it gets really, really cool is that you can actually touch the spot where you're about, where you want to take notes. And you know where it'll take you? It will give you the option to go to your email. And at that point, all of it can get downloaded to whatever email that you choose from tonight's message. Pretty cool deal. Allows you to actually get in and download all of what is happening here tonight. So what does God show us about himself in this first encounter? First, I was going to sneeze. All right, here we go. First, that God starts the process. That he starts the process. Billy Joel actually had it right. We didn't start the fire. I know. That's mainly for David Glass. Neither did Moses. God started it. God was in the mix as Moses was rescued from the river. God was in the mix as Moses ended up in the desert. And God is in the mix now. In this moment, initiating this conversation with Moses, God came seeking Moses. And whether or not we realize it or not, God comes to us each day initiating that relationship. I wonder if maybe that's why the whole Jesus calling series has been so popular over the last few years. Some people like the idea of a writer putting words into God's mouth. Some people don't, and I understand both sides of that. Well, what I will tell you is I think that one of the interesting things about that series is it does help us at times understand that God is the initiator, that he's saying things to us through his word, that he's speaking to that he's wanting to speak to us every day, that he comes to us, and even as we wake up and see an amazing family that we are blessed with, or an amazing sunrise that we see out the window, or the possibilities that are endless in our life, or the needs that each day we are finding are being met. And God stops us in a minute for a moment and says, I have something I'd like to speak to you about. I'll never forget a seminary professor I had my very first year, and he was very, very, very animated. And what I'll never forget about this particular seminary professor, it was in systematic theology, and he was so adamant about us getting the concept that God came all the way down, and he would get all the way down to the floor, and he would say, God came all the way down for us, not halfway. Again, 80s reference. It's not Kenny Loggins theology. It's not meet me halfway across the sky. It's Billy Joel, we didn't start the fire. It's yes, God started it. He didn't just come halfway and go, okay, now if you can just do the rest, if you could just jump up high enough and get to me, if you can do enough good stuff to get to this point, then we've got a match. He comes all the way down to us. And he comes all the way down to Moses in this moment. And he meets Moses there in the desert. And in John 6, verse 44, Jesus says these words, "No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him." Jesus was pointing us to this fact that God is here and he is initiating. But I need to clean up first, God. No, that's not what I'm looking for. But I need to, no, actually, I'm here. Verse 3. So Moses said, I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight, why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. So I was listening to this passage this week on my phone, on the auditory version of this. And different narrators will narrate depending on what translation you pull up on YouVersion. And so I can't remember what translation it was, but I was listening to it, and I wrote exactly how the translation went. But the guy on it, he says, he said it like this. He goes, like he's Moses' voice, he says, I must go over and look at this remarkable sight. And I'm thinking, that's not how that happened at all. I mean, seriously, if you look out your window and there's a tree across the street that's on fire and there's an angel of the Lord in it calling your name, you're not going, I must walk across the street to that remarkable sight. Let me go see what that is. You know, that's not, no, that's not it. Moses, I mean, he is wowed at this moment, certainly freaked out. But I think what is so very important to me about this portion of the story is that God makes it personal. He makes it personal. Not like this. We've been doing, I don't know how many of you here have small children, but this is like difficult week, right? This is the calm before the storm. This is making all the Valentines. And it's just, I know some of you are like going, because it's like awful. I mean, we liked it as kids, but now we're trying to get all the Valentines ready to be given out, you know. And here's one that one of my kids has already received, all right. And I'm not going to say who it's from because it might be your child. But in the blank where it says two, it says you. That was so thoughtful. I mean, you thought of me. It's to me. Oh, to you. Really? Oh, how sweet. It means something when our name is spoken, right? And it means something to us, but it meant something back then too. As a matter of fact, in the Hebrew, if the name is repeated, it is a significant moment. It is endearment. It is friendship. It is intimate. It is affectionate. There's something that I want to tell you. There's something that I want to share with you. And now I'm going to say your name. It's like when I open my mail. You may have had this experience. You open up your mail and you read something like, Randy, I'm so excited about what I'm going to tell you. Someone wants to buy your 2004 Honda Odyssey. And I can make that happen for you today. And I feel loved because they mentioned my name. Now, okay, not every time. Not every time. But you know, when our name is spoken, yes, it is personal and it is authentic. And okay, maybe not every time in our culture, but in this moment, certainly. God wanted to make sure Moses understood this is personal. And maybe in the room tonight, what you needed more than anything else was just to stop at this remarkable truth about God, that he knows your name. And that it is personal. And that he didn't just create you and then spin off into somewhere else. And he didn't just create you and said, okay, well, I hope all that works out nice to you in heaven. But he actually created each one of us. And he is still in the moment with us. And it is personal. And for years, as a youth pastor, we would always walk back to this particular verse that I'm about to read to you. And, you know, it's funny because we would look at it specifically with seniors quite often, you know. And it's Jeremiah 29:11. And I think sometimes it winds up getting taken out of context or there's things that are associated with it that might not should be. But I think what this does do is it does show us the heart of God. It does actually point us to having a better understanding about this God that we serve and worship and seek to know. Because just as he was speaking to the people of Israel and speaking about plans he had for them, I believe that his heart is the same for us. His character is the same. For I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me and I will listen to you and you will seek me and find me. When you search for me with all your heart, I will be found by you, declares the Lord. plans for us. And I think what's interesting about that passage is that he says, okay, here are the plans for you that I have, and here's the five-step process. No, actually what he says is, here's how you get to those. You come to me. And you know what? I'm easily found. Moses was found by God. And not that God ever lost him, or that he ever loses us. But this reminds me of when we were living in Knoxville, and Riley, our second child born, was about 2 years old, two or three years old, I guess, when we first moved there. And we were in our living room, and she would love to play hide and seek. And I can remember her going behind the curtains, right? And our curtains didn't go all the way down to the ground. And she would be behind the curtains, and then she would say, okay, come and find me. And you saw her feet underneath there, and you see the curtain moving, and then I would just kind of wait for a minute, because I knew inevitably she was going to go, okay, you can come and find me. You know, it's like she wanted to be found. She wanted to be found. God is not a God who is playing some sadistic form of hide and seek with us. As a matter of fact, he's actually whispering to us in this moment, I am here. And it's personal. I pray in our boys' room at night, and sometimes, not every night, but oftentimes I will say, and God has big plans for you. And I'll either say that to them, or I will pray that over them, that God has big plans for them. And I did that one day earlier, the earlier part of this week, and over Levi, and all of a sudden, he opened up his eyes, and he looked at me and said, I know he does. And it kind of freaked me out, you know? I thought he was asleep, you know? Do you? Do you believe it? Do you believe he's got big plans for you? Even now, in this moment? Do you hear him speak your name? Is it personal? Exodus 3:5. Then he said, do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. Was that ground holy because it was some special part of the earth? No. God was helping Moses clue into the reality that God is holy. Don't come any closer. And you're like, but I thought God was like really super approachable. Like God, you know, He is a friend of mine. And, you know, what about those worship songs that we sing about, you know, he's my friend, and I can just sit in his lap and be hugged by him, and that special affection of God. And yes, God is that. But he is also, Hebrews 12:29, a consuming fire. He's also holy. And I believe that when we use his name as an exclamation point, when we're no longer bothered by his name taken in vain in our entertainment, when we're so casual with God that we attempt to fashion him in our own image, according to what we believe is culturally relevant, what we think is easy, what the majority of our people in our culture or our country think about a particular issue, when we fashion him in that way, it's moments like that that our lives fail, I believe, to point to his holiness. And the fact that God requires holiness of us. Even when it isn't cool, even when it's hard, even when it places us in the minority. Remember 1 Peter 1:16, you shall be holy, for I am holy. And in this moment, God is just reminding us of who he is and who he calls us to be. Exodus 3:6, and he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Fear, awe, overwhelmed. Moses hides his face, and that's completely understandable. But what I want us to see in this verse is another truth about God, and that is that God gives perspective. He gave perspective here. God connects himself with Moses' past. He connects himself with Moses' forefathers. He says, I am the God of your family, Moses. And this is bigger than you. And what I'm inviting you into is a bigger picture than just what you see standing here in the desert, barefoot, in this moment. And it's bigger than why you think you ended up here. And it's bigger than the fact that you feel like you failed at being a deliverer. It's bigger than all of that, Moses. And I get it. I realize you had some really noble plans, but it's bigger than your plans. This drawing is so much bigger than what you've been able to see up to this point. And you know what? We've been there, right? We get it. Maybe you've heard a testimony, or maybe this has been your testimony to say, you know, I wasn't able to see how God was going to use that job transfer until I saw what happened in my family. You know, I really wasn't able to see how losing that money was going to be used by God to show me what is really important in life. You know, I wasn't able to see how getting so sick was going to be used by God to show me peace and presence and his patience and healing and provision. The bigger picture, it always reminds me of Isaiah chapter 40. When God speaks these words, who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens with a span and closed the dust of the earth in a measure and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Who has measured the spirit of the Lord or what man shows him as counsel? Whom did he consult and who made him understand? Who taught him the path of justice and taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket and are accounted as the dust on the scales. Behold, he takes up the coastlands like fine dust. Lebanon would not suffice for fuel, nor are its beasts enough for a burnt offering. All the nations are as nothing before him. They are accounted by him as less than nothing and emptiness. To whom then will you liken God, or what likeness compare with him? What's happening in this exchange with Isaiah? He's expanding the picture. It's a bigger picture. It's really not about you. It's really not about you. It's about me. You know that, right? But God does want us, in a sense that he wants to use us, and he does want to use us right where we are. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1, surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, he wants us to recognize that in this moment, we are connected into a line, a long line of those who are God seekers. A long line that combines people like Martin Luther and John Calvin and St. Augustine and Jonathan Edwards and John Wesley. It has people in it like the Apostle Paul and the disciples and Elijah and Isaiah and David and Moses and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Hebrews 11, 33, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword. Others were tortured and refused to be released. Some faced jeers and flogging, while others still were chained and put in prison. They were stoned. They were sawed in two. They were put to death by the sword, destitute, persecuted, mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. You are in that line. Have you thought of that recently? The line of those whom God chooses to change the world and change the eternal destiny of millions so that they might know him. And it's a line at times who have used Christ's name to do awful things. Yes, current events today in our news, that is correct. There are things that have been done in the name of Jesus that were destructive and murderous and hateful, but those actions were not followed by some mandate they received from Jesus. Because Jesus says, love your enemies. As a matter of fact, I can't find anywhere in the Gospels where Jesus ever said anything like, quote, fight and kill the disbelievers wherever you find them, take them captive, harass them, lie in wait, and ambush them using every stratagem of war. Just saying. I digress. Exodus 3, verse 7, the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I am aware of their sufferings. So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians and to bring them up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Amorite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite and the Termite and the... Always gets a laugh. Now behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. You see, in this passage, I find a different God than what many are attempting to follow around our globe. You know what I find in that portion of this encounter with Moses? A compassionate God. It's the compassionate God that we find in the person of Jesus Christ in the New Testament. It's the compassionate God that we find in these words right here. Moses is being told by God that God sees and that he hears and that he knows the plight of the people. And interestingly, this is not a new concept. We saw this last week, you remember, at the conclusion of chapter 2. That God heard their groaning. And what did he do? He remembered their covenant. And it's not like he was like, oh, well, I totally forgot about those people. But in the Hebrew, it's remembering as in, and now I'm choosing to act upon what it is that I have promised. God has always known. He's never stopped seeing. But now he is going to deliver, to respond according to what he has promised. And catch this, he is responding because of his nature. That's where this kind of gets a little bit confusing, but really cool. The fact that he sees implies that he is going to act, because he can't help from acting as he is seeing, because you know what? It's all connected. It's not only that he sees what's going on, but he also has the power to do something about what's going on. And crazy enough, he wants to. And so in our life, we serve a God who is not lacking power to accomplish his ends. He is also not lacking vision to be able to see what's going on. He has a plan, and he can enact it. And you know, he chooses to do so in a way that is congruent with his heart. All three of them working together, one implying the other. Matthew 9:36. How does this look like in Jesus' heart? Seeing the people, he felt compassion for them because they were distressed and dispirited like sheep without a shepherd. He was compassionate for them. And we know that as he went to the cross, it was a heart broken for the ones who were nailing him upon it. He cares. Did you need to just rest in that tonight, maybe? Coming toward the end here, Exodus 3:10. Therefore, come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. God invites us into the mission. He invites us in. Does he have to? No, but he does. Does he need us? No, we do not serve a needy God. We're about to jump into Hack and Feed the Hunger and a dozen different mission trips to finish out the year. But you know what? Let's never, ever, ever be under the illusion that God needs us. We don't serve a needy God. He invites us into this amazing plan. And as a result, he does things in us to show him himself. He does things in us to remind us of our purpose and what he's created us for. But he's not doing it because he needs us. He is doing it because he loves us. Exodus 3:11, but Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? And he said, certainly I will be with you, and this shall be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. What are you saying there? Moses, this isn't about you. It's about me. How many times a day do we need to be reminded of this? And in this exchange, God also shows us that, you know what else he shows us? Number 7, he also shows us that God values faith over sight. God gives him assurance, but first it's going to take faith to go back to Egypt. Oh, Moses, you know what? Here's what's going to happen. At the end, you're going to wind up back here. And he has no idea what it's going to take from that point to getting back to there. And as a matter of fact, I'm sure what's going through Moses' mind is, I'm headed to execution. Because we found out in chapter 2, toward the end, that the Pharaoh that wanted Moses dead is now dead himself. But there's no indication in chapter 3 that that insight has gotten to Moses. Maybe so, maybe not. We don't know. Let's assume for a minute that he hasn't, that it hasn't gotten to him, that he doesn't know that that Pharaoh is dead. Where is he headed? Back to the guy that wants to kill him. Where is he headed? Back to the people that have already rejected him. And God's saying, yes, I want you to go back to those people that have already rejected you. And I want you to go back to that Pharaoh who's ready to kill you. And I want you to be their deliverer. Is this going to take a little bit of faith? Just a tad. He's going to have to trust the heart of God as he heads back. But you know what? God never promises us that even the first step is easy. He doesn't. That's what's so crazy about faith, right? It's not just that we don't know the 1,700 steps from here to there. He's not even promised us the first one's easy. But what he does say is 2 Corinthians 5:7, we walk by faith, not by sight. Exodus 3:13. Then Moses said to God, behold, I am going to the sons of Israel, and I will say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. Now they may say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God, if I go back there, you say you sent, and you sent me, you do realize that they are going to wonder if you're the same God that's left them there all these years. I mean, in essence, that's what Moses is saying. You do realize, God, that this is what they're going to think. Can we get a little bit of clarification here? Can you let me know a little bit more about you? And you know what's funny is if you go back into chapter 2 again, what did it end with? It also ended with the Israelites doing what? Finally calling out to God. And I just wonder if maybe God is just in that interaction with Moses. We don't have these words from God. But I just wonder if God is thinking, wow, you know, isn't this crazy? Moses, he doesn't even know this is really going to, I mean, these people are going to, this is an answer to their prayers. They're finally calling out for me. He says, I am. God's name is almost always translated Lord, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D in the English Bible. But the Hebrew would be pronounced something like Yahweh, and is built on the word I am. God is. I am who I was. I am who I am. I am who I will be. There is no time stamp on that in Hebrew, so it's all of the above. I am who I was. I am who I am. I am who I will be. Unchanging nature. Don't you think that that is so very important, an anchor for Moses as he goes, okay, this is a God that I really can trust. This is a God who has always been, that he has caused to be, that he sustains. He says, I am, Moses, I am enough. Last one tonight, number 8. God is sufficient. Philippians 4:19, and my God will supply all your needs according to his riches in glory in Christ Jesus. But God, I just don't, what do I say? I just don't, no, Moses, it's not about you. I am enough. We finish up the chapter with these verses. God furthermore said to Moses, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial name to all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has appeared to me saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you in Egypt. So I said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Amorite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite, to a land flowing with milk and honey. They will pay heed to what you say, and you with the elders of Israel will come to the king of Egypt and will say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. So now please let us go for a three days' journey. Actually, that's an idiom in the Hebrew. It's as if today a teenager comes up to mom and dad and says, can I borrow the car keys? They know they're not just interested in taking the car keys and inspecting them for the next 4 hours. There's something more significant that's about to happen. And hopefully the car will return in one piece. And in this moment right here, it's like saying that. So it's like, hey, this 3-day journey was like him saying, there's a major trip with significant implications that I want to take these people on, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not permit you to go except under compulsion. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my miracles, which I shall do in the midst of it. And after that, he will let you go, and I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall be that when you go, you will not go empty-handed. But every woman shall ask her of her neighbor and the woman who lives in her house articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing, and you will put them on your sons and daughters. Thus you will plunder the Egyptians. He's saying here in detail what is about to take place, and all Moses needs to do is trust him. But it's still a big ask. It's still a big command. It's still a big step of faith. And so tonight, we looked at quite a few revelations of God. And they weren't quite as funny as Charles Dickens or Abraham Lincoln's. But I'm not sure that those revelations impact our eternity like these do. Tonight we saw that God starts the process, and he makes it personal, and he requires holiness and gives us perspective, that he's a God who models compassion and invites us into the mission, that he values faith over sight, and that at the end of the day, he's sufficient. So there's two questions we end with as we close in our worship time, and they're on the screen. Actually, two statements that you can finish. Tonight, I needed to hear that God, what? What did you need to hear? And number two, my action step on this knowledge will be, to go back to the slide before, what is it of those revelations about who God is? What did you need to hear tonight? And what's the next step? God, thank you for reminding us and for revealing to us again who you are, what it is that you want to do in us is personal, and that you're initiating it, and that you are a God of compassion who is enough. Each one of these, a sermon in itself could be built on, and yet all of this compact into this moment with Moses, this moment with us. So God, we're listening. God, we come to you with gratefulness, even as we step into the communion time and as we take communion together. We do so remembering with gratefulness the God that you are, the God that came all the way down for us in your Son, Jesus. God, is this cracker, this juice symbolizes the body and the blood. God, my heart is filled with gratitude that you came all the way down. So God, give us Please, God, give us insight into the next step. And may we take it in faith, because we can trust you, because you're sufficient.